I want some books added to our intelligence center. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to add them now or at a later time, but since I mentioned it in the message today, now is as good a time as any. Every Christian should read, or pay attention when I read it, America B.C., Ancient Settlers in the New World. What is so amazing is by Barry Fell. We're going to get it in our bookstore. Are the illustrations of Celtic writings as early as 500 B.C., scattered all over these United States. Right here is an Iberian ogham inscribed in stone from Vermont. These drawings are taken off of the rock itself. You'll notice the ogham for Leah. Now, the stone of destiny is Leophale, the ancient Hebrew, and ogham, an Irish word for stone. This American ogham inscription uses the Iberian form of ogham, in which vowels are omitted, like Hebrew. Much older than the Irish ogham. Date from the late Bronze Age, as shown by Punic letters associated with them of dated types. The inscription here reads, Stone of Bel. Isn't that interesting? An ancient Canaanite god. Now, the story in chapter 3 of how Irish ogham was deciphered is, you know, a story that people like me just salivate over, but you may not be that much of a historian. Here's one of the ancient tracts written in two languages that begin to give the clue to deciphering ancient ogham out of an Irish monastery, which gives the Celtic connections for the translation of ogham. They then begin to understand why some gods were buried with their fingers and hands different ways, because they were buried with a message in their own hands, or the statues had messages in their own hands in ogham. Now, here is an early Celtic explorer of Oklahoma. He cut his autograph in two languages on a rock face on Turkey Mountain near Tulsa. Gloria Farley discovered it. The upper line of ogham script reads from left to right. Gwyn, a common Celtic name which means white or fair-haired. Below, reading from left to right, are the North Iberian letters, Paya'a, spelling Punic word which also means white, corresponding to the modern Arabic word. The date of the inscription is about 500 B.C. So this early Celtic explorer was writing in two languages, which gives the cross-check. Now, here again is the ogham tract that began to give the key, because it was written in two languages, in the Book of Ballymote in the library of the Irish Academy in Dublin, or Dublin, that gave the key to deciphering what science as a whole had ballyhooed, saying it was just random child's type scribblings. Vested interest in science will always squelch something new in spite of their so-called pursuit of truth. Now, a common method of writing in ogham in Ireland, a common method was to put it, because ogham reads, let me give you a picture before I go into that again. Let me show you something. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The radio can't see this, and I'm very sorry. But Ogham is written along a stem line, see? A stem line will give you certain letters that are below the line, certain letters are above the line, and then intercepts, where they're on both sides of the line. So Ogham is always written in relationship to a stem line. Now, sometimes the edge of the rock was the stem line, as in this case of Irish Ogham. In the American example, let me see if I can find the place where this one was. It is from the Susquehanna Valley. Again, the same practice of Ogham that's written on each side of the stem line. Let me just give you some more. Now, these examples are from Raymond, New Hampshire. These Ogham writings, just to pick a few random ones out. Now, there were some people who tried to say Ogham was the result of carving blocks of stone in the early days of building. You can easily see the difference and see the marks where the tools had made the writings. Now, here are some New World chiefs with Old World names. Above is the tombstone of a Vermont ruler named in Ogham characters as Yogan. Modern spelling, this would be rendered Yogan. The original form of the widespread Celtic family names Ewan and McEwan in Scotland and Ireland, or of Evan and Effan in Wales, with derivative forms such as Bevan. This ancestor of their clan apparently ruled in New England around 500 B.C. Below the inscribed portion of the large block of stone carrying the name in Ogham characters, probably to be rendered as Lugmab Bambino, Lug son of Valiant. Lug is still a name used in the Old World, and Lug probably meant a devotee of the Celtic god Lug. Now here's a long stretch. North American example of a lapidary inscription in the style of Hinge Ogham. Sample number 3 in that Ogham tract that gave the key out of the monastery in Dublin. Shown here is a latex mold collected on Manana Island by Monhegan Island, about 10 miles offshore from the coast of Maine. This alphabet is a Bronze Age predecessor of Irish Ogham. The inscription reads from right to left, translates ships from Phoenicia, cargo platform. I mean, we're back past 500 B.C. when they had a cargo platform built and labeled for Phoenician ships. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
And some of the symbols of sun worship had these lattice marks. These are from Portugal. These are from South Royalton, Vermont. Identical patterns, identical meanings, identical worship. Now, Ogham could take the shape of finger signals. Of course, we've degenerated in intelligence in the modern world. We only have one or two such meaningful symbols. Now, I've tried to move us back toward the intelligence of the Irish world by adding a few additional fingers, but we've somewhat degenerated as time has gone on. Now, all over New England and northeastern part of the United States, great destruction occurred in what they thought to be root cellars, what they considered to be storage places for the keeping of roots. We call them spud cellars in Idaho, and they are spud cellars built by the people for that purpose. But the original so-called root cellars in the Northeast were not root cellars at all, but rather burial places or worship places of these ancient Celts, or memorial places. But because the assumption was that nobody was here but the Indians who didn't know how to read and write, and that there was no ancient heritage in this land, they would take those stones, deface them, use them for buildings, and the only analogy would be what the Arabs did when they began to take and deface the pyramid and use it in their buildings. We did it here because we thought there was no mystery. One of the most important finds near Mystery Hill in New Hampshire is this triangular dedication tablet found in the ruins of a small rectangular stone chamber at Mystery Hill, New Hampshire, now recognized as a winter solstice noon transit temple observatory. The inscription in Iberian characters reads from left to right, or rather from right to left, to Baal of the Canaanites, though the word is Phoenician Canaanites, this in dedication. Subsequently, an Ogham dedication was also found showing that Bel, the sun god of the Celts, was identified with Baal of the Semitic people. So they have absolute proof in many places that the Celts were there first, but allowed at some of the same worship centers Phoenicians to come and leave their inscriptions and worship Bel in the same place that Baal was being worshipped, and Baal in the same place that Bel was being worshipped. Now, one of the major contributions of this book is its discussion and very accurate unfolding of the meaning, both specific to the original city in Spain and generically for biblical prophecy meanings of the ships of Tarshish. Now that's on page 93. Now I got to dangle something today, so I'm not going to read that chapter to you. Here's a good one. Whereas colonists from Iberia have left us inscriptions cut into the masonry of temples and on tablets buried in funeral mounds, casual visits by explorers are usually recorded as cliff inscriptions or on massive rocks near the coast. This one is exceptional, for although its Iberian Punic text tells us that the men who engraved it were visiting mariners, it was found 1,000 miles inland in caves in Paraguay. The explanation that Eric Reinert gives us is that Paraguay River is navigable to this point by seagoing ships. The inscription in standard Iberian script reads in translation, "Inscription cut by mariners from Cadiz," that's in Spain, "exploring." We're back before Christ was born. Explorers from Spain. Now, the work in deciphering these has so expanded that entire documents, this happens to be a contract with a shipping vessel with its captain, giving the terms under which he would carry things and how he would receive payment. This one was discovered in Brazil in 1886. Published in 1939. discovery of the West Indies goes back as far as 800 B.C., here recorded in Ogham script, an old Celtic language, by Mab or Mabo, a Celtiberian sea captain who left this inscription cut on a rock on St. Vincent Island on the southern in the southern Antilles. It reads, Mabo discovered this remote western isle in Celtic Iberian script. Now, wouldn't it be something if one of these days they discover something, some of those books that are referenced in the Bible and the Old Testament that have been lost, if they discover one of them written in Ogham? I keep going. No, I don't know if I should put this in the bookstore yet or not. I'm not sure you're ready for it. Here is an outdoor altar of Apollo, or Mabo Mabona, god of youths, whose name means hero of heroes or youth of youth, located at South Woodstock, Vermont. Can you hold them on it? Wish I could show this on radio. Ogham inscriptions in Oklahoma. Here's some of them. The voyagers apparently ascended the Mississippi, Arkansas, and Cimarron rivers and left inscriptions and burial mounds. There's a full study of the Eye of Belli. This book is unbelievably researched. And ties in the Egyptian, the Libyan, the Celtic, and Phoenician BC history. Now, what happened to all these people? Huh? Did that interest you? Where'd all these people go? I mean, were Indians just Indians? Now, he traces the Zuni. He traces the Algonquins. It's a fascinating book. I have one other little thing to point out to you. And then I'm just going to leave this. Because I know, I can tell by the way you're acting, I'm boring the living daylights out of you. How many of you knew about all this? You know anything about this? Just thought there's a bunch of dumb Indians over here dragging their women around by the hair and shooting arrows when they got lost up in the air. See, Ogham is now broken down into Ogham P and Ogham Q. And we're talking about a much maligned study that only in this century began to really take off. So how could the theology up until 1900, which represents the seedbed of most theological preaching today? I mean, I'll guarantee you, you walk in the average preacher's study, his commentaries date from the 1800s. We have been passing on the same traditions over and over and over and over again. There's three types of Ogham that can be recognized in Spain. And one of them I really like, because the Ogham tract calls it Cuss Ogham. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. It's C-O-S, Ogham. I like that. Cuss Ogham. And you know, Ogham had refinements. You could work out your own little special message. You could agree in one city to vegetable Ogham. And you would give each separate letter of the alphabet a different vegetable. So you could talk to one another. Watermelon, pumpkin, apple, banana, grape. And if you had already agreed on the code, you could communicate and understand each other. I can't find what I'm looking for. I know it's here. How Irish Ogham was deciphered. During the past 3,000 years, the shores of America were visited by mariners, sometimes by colonists, from several different civilizations that once flourished on the other side of the Atlantic. Now, the Celts had been a lifelong interest for me, he says, ever since my college days. When Celtic inscriptions stared back at me from America, I want to tell you something. This fella, I find no indication anywhere in his research, and I think he's a Harvard professor. I think he's teaching at Harvard right now. Yeah, Harvard professor, Barry Fell. So I'm going to talk about some, you know, Freako. I'm going to talk about Richard Brothers. The guy's a Harvard professor. Founder of a society dedicated to this research. The biggest problem they've had is money. Because their vested interests in the scientific world were as hard on them as they were at the outset, the works of Schliemann. After Schliemann, I've said this a dozen times, after Schliemann dug up Troy by taking Homer as history instead of sheer myth, one guy had already published his interpretation of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey as a poetic description of wind currents and waves. And he went ahead and published it. Even though Schliemann, using Homer, found Troy. Vested interests, all of history had to be written. You know where history starts? How many of you know the definition of history? It starts with a written language. Everything else is called prehistory or proto-history. Now history is pushed back so far, everybody's theory is blown apart. Absolutely blown apart. They thought that hieroglyphics in Egypt was picture drawings like cavemen drawing pictures on a wall. It was an alphabet. Highly sophisticated and very complicated. When they uncovered Linear A and Linear B in that marvelous civilization on Crete that I happen to think is Noah's. I think that's where Noah settled after the flood. He was better at building ships than anybody else, and that's what they were famous for. And the dates are right. When they began to decipher cuneiform writings, then history books start over again. They got close when they recognized the Phoenicians were there first. Well, whom are the Phoenicians direct descendants of? You don't know? You don't know? Where does the word Phoenician come from? I know I've taught on that. I'll do it again. I'm tired of going over the same thing half a dozen times. Ogham means grooved writing. And this guy had been fascinated with self. But what I started to say, he does not make any connections with the lost tribes. He's just a Celtic scholar. The only problem is, he ends up finding them getting started, same date, same place. But he doesn't tell me how they got there. I'm going to tell him how they got there. I mean, a guy this smart needs to know. He says, the Celts have been a lifelong interest for me. Ever since my college days, when Celtic inscription stared back at me from American bedrock, it seemed like the end of a long, tortuous trail that started so many years ago when I was a student at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. If I've exaggerated the importance of the Celtic role in history or in the colonization of America, you can't exaggerate the Celtic role in history. The Celts are more important than the Romans. The Celts are more important than the Greeks. And that blows asunder textbook after textbook after textbook, vested interest after vested interest, and would make you burn large parts of libraries if you wanted to get rid of error. I don't recommend you burn any books, though. I mean, I just get blessed looking at bad books. This is a crowd that worked all night, and they're normally not that slow. Before they turn chicks. I'll never live that one down. In case you weren't listening this morning in church, I was preaching away, talking about turning the other cheek. The only thing is, I turn chicks instead of cheeks. It's awful. It really is. Bad. It's me. I drove a knife truck around, never got out of the cab. If I have exaggerated the importance of the Celtic role in history or in the colonization of America in ancient times, wouldn't it be fun if we didn't have to raise money? If perhaps because I was better equipped to recognize faint trails of their scent, if their scent was Celtic. Well, I'm going to leave that alone. Well, he backs it up by the study that he had done, which is pretty impressive. And the point he's making is that the English scholars were myopic in their view because they were so submerged in the Greek and Roman view of things and the Greco-Roman centrality in the control of history. They couldn't see what happened in Ireland. And because the people in the new land were so convinced nobody is here but scalping Indians. And one wonders, where the Indians learn to scalp? Because the Celts were pretty good at that. And these two frames of reference never came together. The American fact of inscriptions and the British prejudice against giving any credit to anything good coming out of Ireland. Ireland to Britain was like Nazareth to Judea. Am I boring you? And he's talking about the man that was involved in the original transcriptions. He says, the problem confronting Valancy was different in nature from that we encountered in American inscriptions. Whereas he did not have to convince anyone that Celts had once lived in Ireland, this very advantage did him a disservice. For the ancient Irish scribes had no doubts that their Celtic alphabet could be understood in a Celtic land, and so they never once felt obliged to compose bilingual inscriptions in dual alphabets. The Celts had been in Ireland so long, they were so closed off, they had no need in Ireland to inscribe the Ogham writings in two languages, which is always the key for decipherment. The Rosetta Stone gives you the key to hieroglyphics because it has more than one on it. The Behista monument opens the cuneiform inscriptions and identifies the socket because there are three languages on it, and you can begin to cross-reference the words. But Ireland though everybody knew the Celts were there, the disservice was that Ogham writings could be discounted as just scratchings on a rock because there was never any need for the Ogham writer to put it down in two languages. That's why it took the discoveries in America to begin to open up the research into the language, because the Celts arriving here were arriving in new territory and inscribing in more than one language, because it became a crossroads of Libyan, Phoenician, and Celtic mariners. That's all he's saying. So the methods we used in North America were not available to decipher and give credence to Ogham. Old Irish monks, however, had composed books about Ogham. And it was through one of these we learned the nature of this ancient script. In his recent lecture series and book, Civilization, Lord Kenneth Clark has depicted the monks of Ireland in the Dark Ages as the repository of learning while Europe lay shattered by barbarian invaders. In their stone cells and remote islet hermitages, these devoted servants of God somehow contrived to keep the oil burning and the few fragile lamps that survived the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. For four centuries, a lot of people don't know this. They know about potato famine and Irish going everywhere and the wars in Ireland today. But for four centuries, monks in Ireland alone preserved the learning of the ancients in Europe. Later, as petty kingdoms were replaced by more stable institutions of government, the monks emerged to establish more splendid houses of the church until, by the 9th century A.D. and the onset of the Middle Ages, a steady stream of manuscripts was generated to fill the libraries of those bishops who cared for learning or had the wealth to commission copies of ancient works for their own delight. Not all of the manuscripts can be classified as works of art, but some of the more commonplace in execution contain information that's priceless. One such volume is known to us as the Book of Ballymote. This celebrated book is thought to have been assembled about 800 years ago from a collection of miscellaneous transcripts, or manuscripts. The last manuscript included in the book is known as the Ogham Tract, because it deals with about 70 varieties of ancient Celtic script called collectively by the name Ogham, which means grooved writing. It is thought this name may be derived from an ancient Greek word, ogmi, meaning groove, though some Celtic tradition attributes the script to a god called Ogmios. The principle of Ogham writing as set out in the Ogham Tract is simple enough. It is, in fact, an alphabet comprising 15 consonants and 5 vowels, together with a few other signs representing double letters such as the sound NG and diphthongs. The letters are constructed from single parallel strokes placed in sets of 1 to 5 in positions above, across, or below a guide or tract line. I'm looking for a date. Boy, this is interesting. It reads like Layard and the discovery of the Rosetta Stone. Valency, who had the honor of having discovered how the hitherto mysterious notched stones of the Celtic lands are to be read. And his pioneer work eventually resulted in nearly 400 Ogham monuments coming to light in various parts of the British Isles. Amazing. And you know when he discovered and for the first time translated Ogham? His letter announcing it was dated June 24th, 1784. But it wasn't until well into the 1800s that the critics stopped putting him down, and suddenly a turnaround occurred beginning in 1877 with conclusions coming out of Professor Rees' work in a book on Welsh philology, that finally Ogham was accepted as a language and they began to work on it. So now we're into 1877. It's not until the 1900s that the corollary work in the American inscriptions begin to burst on the scene, and this research could be released to the world. In our century. And yet history keeps rolling along teaching the same garbage. You pick up book after book, it's going to tell you the Celts had no written language. Horse spit. I think I'm going to put the... I don't know. Joe, see if you can find this. Otherwise, they're going to go empty every bookstore in town anyway. America B.C. by Barry Fell. You need it. You'll read it. It's one of the few books that I don't have to apologize for anything that's in it. It is basically a hard-nosed scientific presentation of the evidence for Celtic inscriptions going back to 500 B.C. and before in these United States of America and other sections of the New World. They would have us believe that maybe an Irish monk made the trip to Iceland and Greenland and Labrador in a little old leather canoe. Julius Caesar, in his great battle where he defeated the Celtic navy, describes in 55... Within 55 years of Christ, the nature of these big, keeled, swan-like ships, so much bigger than the Roman ships, that they were helpless to defeat until they used the grappling techniques, and then the Romans could clamber over the sides of the ship and engage in hand-to-hand battle and overwhelm them by their massive numbers and their massive manpower. But the ships, do you know that the ships would carry up to 200 and 300 men, whereas that little old piddling thing that Columbus took would only carry about 50 or 60? Yet Columbus made the trip. These Celts had ships far and above the ones Columbus took, and the winds were blowing the same way. And Julius Caesar is amazed at the ability of these Celtic vessels to sail against the wind. And yet some historian will tell us. I mean, no preacher needs to apologize for God's word. It's about time science starts facing up to the cracks in its halo. And history starts facing up from the historian's view to the cracks in their halo, and face up to the fact that history is his story, the guy who's telling it. The greatest boat builder of them all fathered Shem. And Shem followed the father of the Semites. The greatest civilization of the Mediterranean, the Cretan civilization, Noah's, I believe. Those palaces, or the Palace of Knossos, is a marvel of a great civilization wiped out in a day. It is such a marvel because it had no fortifications. It was protected by its navy. Rowboats? Julius Caesar points out that the sailing skill and the size of those Celtic vessels amazed him, because whereas the Romans had to have galley slaves handle it, they didn't have any. Theirs ran with skill of sailing. These Celts and their Phoenician brothers, who had all descended from... I'm going to tell you that again. Told you once. Do your homework. Pahanok, the name of Enoch. The Phoenicians are direct descendants of Enoch. As Noah and Shem were. And all of Shem's descendants did not follow Moses out of Egypt. That's the tie-in to what we've been teaching for a long, long time. That entire Canaanite territory was peopled by the descendants of Noah, who fought over its territory. And the old man lived on Crete. And Shem lived at Jerusalem, otherwise called Melchizedek. And Abram did him obeisance, which makes sense when you understand that Abram was taught in his childhood as he fled the wrath of Nimrod. Many a dumb fool would have stifled that and warped his personality. Fleeing the wrath of Nimrod because of a vision given about the role that Abraham would play. Abram had been trained and taught in his boyhood by Noah and Shem, which gives you the basis for his faith and causes him to oppose his father Terah in Terah's idol worship. The interplay of these descendants of the promised ones of Shem is the hidden subject covered up by so much of false history, as the lost tribes have been covered up by so much traditional and false history. The Celts are none other than the lost tribes. They appear in history north of the Caucasus Mountains is exactly the time that the lost tribes disappear into history, as Ezra says, seeking Arsareth, which means hill or city of Sareth, north of the Black Sea. But they weren't the first Celts. You see, instead of the Greeks being the great fathers of culture, as some historians would have us believe, the Greeks were conquered by that son of the Macedonian, Philip, Alexander the Great, wielding those city-states together, and possessed, I believe, by demoniac power, the prince of Grecia, as he's called in Daniel, smites the prince of Persia, or smites the remnants of the prince of Persia's bands after the angel and Gabriel had smitten him on leaving Daniel. The original aboriginal culture of Greece did not originate the culture that is so respected attributed to the Greeks. It took Cyrus Gordon to show that the Greeks and the Hebrews have a common source, and that Greece became great because of conquerors that came up from Egypt. Troy was founded by a descendant of Zara who fled out of Egypt before the Exodus left, Diodorus of Sicily says, some of them left with Moses, others left by sea. They weren't always in bondage, as we've shown, in Egypt. They came to Egypt as relatives of the absolute despot, the ruler Joseph. They were planted in the richest territory, and under his patronage became the second wave of foreign rulers, the Hyksos in Egypt. Some 40, 50 years before the birth of Moses, which was some 80 years before the Exodus, and the Exodus is pinpointed at 1453 B.C. Some 40 years before, 100 to 120 years before, namely 1550 to 1570 B.C., the Hyksos rule was broken. The death of Joseph, the extended power of his brethren and their descendants brought the hatred of the Egyptians until any shepherd was hated by them. And as they said in answering the Pharaoh's question when they came down in Joseph's day, they said, "We be shepherds." That didn't mean they were scabby, tent-dwelling beggars. They were the shepherd kings. Upper Egypt threw them out. And the rulers left. Many of the merchants and seagoing vessels left. Those that stayed were enslaved. And that's the bunch that Moses led out. For years, we that have studied the heritage of the promise given to Judah, that a son of Judah, that Judah would keep the scepter and rule, have recognized why that strange chapters in the Old Testament of Tamar, where the two twins are born and Zara comes out, his hand comes out first, and the midwife wraps the scarlet cord around his wrist. The hand is drawn back, and then Phares is born. Phares is called breach, Zara is called seed or abundance. The Phares line produced David. The Pharaoh's line produced Jesus of the seed of Judah. But that twin whose hand came out first was a competitor for the right to rule, holding the scepter of the Judah line. And the descendants of Zara were forever frustrated in the Judah predominance in the line of the kings in Palestine, equal heirs to the promises of Judah. At no time, as in the case of Jacob and Esau, and as in the case of Ephraim and Manasseh, did God set Zara aside and give Pharaoh's preeminence. But rather, as there was a struggle in the womb in the case of Esau and Jacob, and Jacob, God's choice of blessing, comes out second, grabbing the heel of Esau. In the case of Phares and Zara, the struggle in the womb caused the hand to come forth and to be drawn back and forever raise the issue without God sorting it out. Who should rule of the descendants of Judah? Phares? Zara. Satan fought the promise. Some of the sons of Judah were the most evil of men. Said God killed two of them. There was some mean God killed them. What does something to your love theology, doesn't it? I'm skipping with 70 league boots through things that I've taught in detail. That frustration is apparent when you watch the heirs to a kingly throne. Charles is not the only heir. The pressure is on the other prince, who must always be prepared for a throne he most likely will not get. He must go through the training and preparation so that should something happen to Charles, he's there. But he knows And depending upon how bad he wants to be king, he probably prays every night for his brother to get up alive or dead. The sons of Zara live in that shadow of Pharaoh and his sons. And when Upper Egypt rises up, the wisdom of these sons is attested to in the Bible. The only way they can compare the wisdom of Solomon is to compare it to the wisdom of the sons of Zara. They overcompensated. You have a family like the Kennedy family, where the old man wants them all to be kings. You have a family like the Rothschilds, where every one of them is pushed forward, yet the Pharaoh's line rules. So when they're driven out of Egypt, you can trace these sons. One of them founds the city of Troy. One of them founds the city of Athens. But they're not the only ones. There is a seagoing tribe that is everywhere being met. When there's a war going on in the 12th century B.C., and Deborah is prophesying, and Barak is to take 10,000 men off of Mount Tabor, as we now know it, in the Holy Land, and attack the Syrians off the edge of the plain of Megiddo, she laments the fact that Dan abode in ships and never came into the battle. Dan's name means to judge. Dan, it was prophesied, would be a serpent by the way, biting a horse's heels. The word means judge. They had a characteristic annotated in the Bible wherever they went. They left their name. They left their seal as a judge. They were to be the authorizer, if you will. The proving up and marking and sealing of the evidence for the trial. In the role of a judge, who orders an exhibit to be marked. Now, building upon Cyrus Gordon's work, we're not talking in Barry Fell's case of a British Israelite. We're not talking in Cyrus Gordon of a British Israelite. Neither are we talking about a British Israelite and Alan H. Jones. Alan H. Jones comes out with a book that builds further upon what Cyrus Gordon had done. Bronze Age Civilization, the Philistines and the Danites. Intros written by Cyrus Gordon. It says, between 1500 and 1000 B.C., crucial developments were taking place in the East Mediterranean. It was then that the Greeks and Hebrews first emerged as coherent entities in history. The Philistines were a sea people whose operations and presence spanned the Aegean world and Palestine. The latter name is our normal English form of Philistia, land of the Philistines. We get the name Palestine from the Philistines. Phoenicians, Philistines, Greeks, Hebrews, all emerging. The key to Alan Jones' study is, for the first time, he unravels a believable etymology for the word Philistine, which has never before been done, in my judgment. Alan Jones has devoted his research for years to the Bronze Age and early Iron Age cultures. Montgomery College, chairman of its English department, resides in Silver Springs, Maryland. Now listen. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
About the time of the Hyksos rule, there's no British Israelite. About the time of the Hyksos rule, now he probably wouldn't agree with me that the Hyksos were none other than Jacob and his family, the relatives of Joseph and their descendants. All he would say is that at the exact time that Joseph is ruling Egypt and his brethren are given power. When the scripture says Joseph ended up owning the land, owning the cattle, owning the money, and moving the people around like checkers. The whole nation was his slave. At the same time that that was going on, and the Bible says they were shepherds, they called themselves shepherds, and there were such powerful kings in Canaan that all the rulers of Egypt went back to Canaan to mourn and participate in the burial of old man Jacob. Yet in spite of all that obvious truth, Sunday school still shows these poor beggar shepherds going down there in the famine to get a handout. And this writer would say the Hyksos were foreign rulers who conquered Egypt without a war and suddenly appear on the scene total rulers of Egypt until about the middle of the 1500s B.C., Upper Egypt drives them out. Now, accidentally and ironically, at the same time, Joseph and his brethren were ruling in Egypt. And interestingly and ironically, when the Upper Egypt armies drive out the shepherd kings, it's them same poor descendants of Joseph that end up slaves. Now, we just really don't know who the Hyksos were that were ruling. We don't know where they went, and we don't know why they weren't enslaved. But these poor, stupid, handout shepherds, Jacob and his family, 70 of them, that ultimately became several million, and Joseph, they were just running Egypt. We don't know. We got these shadowy Hyksos. We don't know who they were. We know that Joseph and his brethren ran a whole show. We know that Joseph and his brethren were shepherds, but they just couldn't be shepherd kings. Isn't this stupid? I mean, if it walks like a dog, barks like a dog, tears up things like a dog, does other things like a dog, most likely it's a dog. If Joseph and his brethren were shepherds and were kings and ruled Egypt and were shepherds and kings and ruling Egypt at the same time the shepherd kings ruled Egypt, why aren't they the shepherd kings? They were. He wouldn't say that. I said it. But he will say, about the time of the Hyksos rule, and perhaps because of it, groups of Semites, that's Shemites, set out from the Levant. Well, Levant is Palestine area. The Levant is that whole ring of the Mediterranean right there. You stamp collectors know that the Levant area is a very complicated, but also a highly interesting and expensive area of stamp collection. A group or groups of Semites set out from the Levant and traveled to distant points of the then known world. Many of these groups had one thing in common. They had acquired and retained the root Dan in the name by which they were known. Huh? Some of them probably migrated into Asia Minor, while others turned westward to the Aegean and the Mediterranean world to become known as Danans, after the name of their leader, Danaus. Later, after much fusion and commingling with other peoples, a portion of them referred to as the Danunu, along with other tribes comprising the Sea Peoples, were to return to the Levant, or Palestine. Another tribe of the Sea Peoples, known as the Pulisates, or the Philistines. The Danunu, or a segment of them, were by a set of strange circumstances ultimately accepted into a confederation of the tribes of Israel and called the tribe of Dan. Now, how's that for a convoluted explanation of a very simple fact? That the Danites were descendants of Jacob and had received a promise that's being fulfilled as they would move and meander like a serpent by the way and would judge their people and follow their people everywhere they went, and the stamp of Dan would locate and seal the actual reality and genuineness of the tribes that supposedly had been lost. Now, there is a possibility that Manetho was right when he maintained that Danaus did not acquire his name until his arrival in Greece. There, according to legend, his group made an early acquaintance with one of the most powerful of the Greek deities. I could go on and on and on and on. I just wanted to read that one simple little line to show you that history is finally catching up. And archaeology is finally proving the case that when God gave a promise, he intended to carry it out. And when he told old Abraham and Sarah that their seed would not only comprise a multitude as great as the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens, but they would become father and mother of kings and multiplied kings, and that they would become father and mother of a commonwealth of nations. And when God expanded the promise through Jacob to Ephraim and to Manasseh, that Ephraim would become a commonwealth of nations and Manasseh would become a great nation. And when God said through Jacob in dividing up the birthright, which is the right because of birth to fulfill every promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that this great multitude of people would divide into two streams, and that the descendants of Joseph would have all of the rights because of birth that had been promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Every single promise would divert to the descendants of Joseph, except two. That the scepter, that's kingship, and lawmaking would remain with the house of Judah. That when God said that, you can expect to find a multitudinous commonwealth of nations and a multitudinous nation that would carry forward every promise to Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Jacob through the house of Joseph, which becomes Ephraim, Samaria, the house of Israel, that are the 10 lost tribes that supposedly disappeared. But at the same time that God gives that promise of a birthright stream that is to go with the lost tribes, he says, paradoxically and ironically, he would protect a king for them of the Judah line, in addition to the kings and multiplied kings that are to come via the Judah line. And the only way, when God said to Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Jacob that their descendants would become a multitude and that their descendants would become a commonwealth of nations and that their descendants, in the case of Manasseh, would go down a channel and become, in that case, one great nation. And he took all those promises and put them in the house of Joseph, including such things as they would possess the gate of their enemies, and no weapon formed against them would prosper when they came to a certain point in their history that was after the death and resurrection of Christ. They could be all that, but if they have a king, the kings have to come out of Judah. Because God said when he divided the birthright, every promise I've given, now, to Abraham, I said, you'll be a multiplied people. To Abraham and Sarah, I said, out of you will come a commonwealth of nations. To Abraham and Sarah, I also said, kings, multiplied kings, will come out of you. When I get to dividing the birthright, every promise goes to the house of Joseph except I hang on to kings and lawmaking. That doesn't go with the multitude. You can be a commonwealth of nations, but the king doesn't come out of Joseph. The scepter and lawmaking stays with Judah. Now, from Judah comes Perez and Zara. That means somewhere you must connect the stream of Judah through Pharez or Zarah in order for the kings over the multitude and commonwealth of nations that went with the Joseph people, they got to flow together. Because the kings via Judah got to somewhere be or get to where the stream of the lost tribes went, because the kingship has to come through Judah. Now, short and simple, that's what the Bible says. And if that doesn't happen, God is a liar. And I'm in the business of revealing God's faithfulness to His Word. And history proves God up. How then, when Judah is carried into bondage in Babylon, how can the kings rule over the lost tribes even if they're found? Well, you see, Judah as the tribe and Judah as the family are not one and the same at the time of bondage. Before Judah the tribe, united under David, was carried into bondage, Judah the family broke into parts way back in Egypt. And the Pharaoh's line stayed with Judah the tribe. The Zarah line split and end up in Spain, among other places. Now, I'm boring you, right? I'm sure I am. You have a responsibility. Don't look bored then. Because if you look bored, I think you're bored. I mean, if a dog barks and walks and looks like a dog, he is a dog. If you look bored, you is bored. Does that make sense? I think I can find this if you'll be patient a moment. One of the ancient... Well, let me show you some. In studying Ogham, you got to be in real study of language. Etymologically, Celtic languages broke into two large divisions. One called the Q-Celts and one the P-Celts. Some of them have vowels and some of them don't. German investigators, over a course of several years of studying the Indo-European or Aryan family of related languages, discovered that during the past 2,000 years or more, certain characteristic changes in pronunciation tend to recur in member languages of the Indo-European family. One of the phonetic changes observed is that an original B, like Bobby, tends to be softened to the sound of V. This change has taken place in Gaelic, but as the original sound of B, I mean, have you ever seen My Fair Lady? How many of you have seen that play or movie and watched the way Harrison, who plays the part, goes through those phonetic sounds to teach you to speak right? Well, that's more or less what's being talked about here. This change from B softened to the sound of V has taken place in Gaelic. But as the original sound of B is often retained in certain grammatical forms of the same word, it would be inconvenient to spell the word with a V in some cases and a B in others when the same word is intended. To overcome this problem, the old Gaelic grammarians hit upon the expedient of inserting an H after the B whenever the B sound is to be replaced by the sound of V. Thus, bata, B-A-T-A. Thus, bata means ship. But bata, B-H, as we would say it, but since that's supposed to be the sound V, B-H-A-T-H, bata, when you say it. So, instead of changing the spelling to a V, they just put an H in when it's to be pronounced with a V. So bata means ship. Vata means of a ship. Pronounced vata, not bata. Similar rules apply to some other letters that undergo changes of the same kind from language to language in a common family group. One of the ancient names of Ireland is let me write it for you. Because you pronounce it differently than it looks. One of the ancient names of Ireland is I-B-H-E-R-I-U. Pronounced I-B-E-R-I-U. Iveriu. But that's the way it's spelled. Probably the word was derived from a still earlier pronunciation. Iberiu. Now, this is very interesting. For the Gaelic histories assert that the ancestors of the Gaels came to Ireland from Iberia, the old name of Spain. Could Iberiu be the same as Iberia? The name of the older homeland having been transferred to the younger? Now, Iberia goes back even further to the original Iberian descendants of someone who settled in the Spanish-Portuguese peninsula. It is from there the Milesian Celts came to Ireland and displaced the Tuatha De Danann. Now we're back to Alan H. Jones, of early seagoing people, centuries earlier direct from Egypt, who settled Ireland as the Tuatha or tribe of Dan, De Danann. Now, Milesian Iberians settle and name it Iverno. Iberiu, from Iberia. Now, where do we get Ia? In the breakdown of the name of the Philistines, probably the most significant contribution of this guy, Alan Jones. I'm in the business of gestalting connections, you know. He found that in the Bible, the only word beginning with phil, whose etymology did not derive from the Greek word phil or phileo, meaning love, was this word Philistine. It was the only one of these words, however, whose origin was listed as Hebrew rather than Greek. What did it mean? Well, the word phili or phylon means tribe. So suddenly, the first little phrase or word of or portion of Philistine, I'm skipping three pages while I say this, is simply the ancient Hebrew word for tribe. Just substitute the Y for the iota, and you have phile or philon, tribe. Now we got tribe histi, Philistine. Where does that come from? Short and simple, it's the tribe of the goddess of the hearth, Hesti or Histi. And when you want to call it a land, the people of the tribe of the goddess of the hearth, Tia, identifies them to the land of the people of the goddess of the heart, or the land of the tribe of the goddess of the heart. Put Ea on the end, you got tribe. Or rather, you got the land of the tribe. Now we're getting close to Iberia. Iberia, you don't have to go very far. I could trace it right back through both of these books. You got the land of the Hebrew. Ibiru. And you're right back to the Hebrews. They were not called Israelites until after the blessings of Jacob and the division of the tribes, because Jacob said to Manasseh and Ephraim, the house of Joseph, they shall bear my name. Judah was not given the right to bear the name of Israel. Jacob said, among other things, when he adopted the two sons of Joseph, they shall bear my name. In that division of the streams of promise, all the rights of birth prior to Jacob were given to the house of Joseph, and Jacob added some, including the right for the house of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, to bear his name. Nobody else. Israel. Prior people or other people get other names. That's why Judah is called Judah. And those who left Egypt were called Hebrews and its various derivatives. Hebrews left Egypt on ships of Dan and ships of Phoenician sailors, settled in Troy, settled in Greece, and settled in Spain. That's why Solomon later is going to collect tribute out of Spain. Where do you think Zaragoza came from? That great name. Guadalajara in the Arabic. It's the Valley of the Hebrews, what it means originally. The Hebrews were settled in Spain by the time that Moses was leading the rest of the Hebrews out in the Exodus. The tribe of Dan was already in Ireland. And it was these same descendants peopling the Iberian Peninsula that attracted sections of the lost tribes to make their way to the territory of their brethren on the Iberian Peninsula and in Ireland. And it was these same westward ho explorers who took the inscriptions of Ogham that come from the Iberian Peninsula and from Ireland to America B.C. Even while and before the lost tribes ever reached their brethren that were already in the Iberian Peninsula. Now back to Zara and Judah. These descendants of Judah, Zara, were already in the Iberian Peninsula, Zaragoza. These descendants of Zara founded Troy, and in the chronicles of Geoffrey of Monmouth, which history will prove has got substance as Homer's Iliad and Odyssey had substance, it's a descendant of Zara, Brutus, that takes the Trojans that have been defeated in ships to the same place, seeking the brethren that they knew were already settled in the Iberian Peninsula, and on up to England to found new Troy that became London. These same tribes, as they meandered across the northwestern part of Europe, end up converging on that Iberian Peninsula, converging in northwest Europe, in the Scandinavian islands, and on the British Isles. But ahead of them, the kingly line had already gone. Zara in Troy, through Brutus to England. Zara in Greece. Zara in England, in Italy, as the Brutus story tells. Zara, the Milesians, who take the king conquering the Tuatha De Danann to establish the High Kings of Ireland, and it is a direct descendant of Zara, that is, the King of Ireland. Now God's got one more little chunk in the puzzle he must link. For his response to David makes him add some additional promises to David. As Jacob added the promises to Joseph, your family will bear my name, but Judah will keep the scepter and the lawmaking. The Judah line of Pharaohs reaches such a prominence in the life of David that God gives to David within the stream of the Pharaoh's Judah line an additional promise that his seed will establish a dynasty that will rule over Israel, and there will never be, as long as the sun's up and the moon's in the sky, a time when the descendant of David is not available to sit on the throne. Now, the promises to Abraham and Sarah of multiplied kings, and the promise to Joseph that they will become the commonwealth of nations and the mighty nation, are brought together when the commonwealth of nations, the lost tribes, and the mighty nation Manasseh, by God's hand, as Micah said, scattered through the wilderness, not a grain of corn will drop, are led to their appointed place in the isles, where God has already placed the Judah line through Zara as kings in the Milesian kings of Spain and in the kings of the High Kings of Ireland. Now we got another problem. Into that stream must flow the David line, because David, ruling over the kingdom of Judah, his descendants, virtually wiped out in the male line by the work of Nebuchadnezzar, yet God said David would rule over Israel. Israel's in the isles. By the time the Pharaoh's line is wiped out in the male lineage by Nebuchadnezzar, how then do we get the David branch ruling over the Israelites in the same way God got the Zara branch ruling over the Israelites, the commonwealth of nations and the mighty nations that come out of the lineage of the Joseph line, the 10 tribes? The Zara king was there before they got there. The tribes are taken by God to where the Zara king is. Now, the Zara king ruling over the descendants of the lost tribes in Ireland, God now has the problem of getting the David line to them. Enter Jeremiah as the trustee. Enter the daughters of Zedekiah. Enter the tender twig of the prophecy of Ezekiel that God takes in the custody and trusteeship of Jeremiah, and on ships of Dan again they sail, and the king of the David line through the female lineage of the daughter of Zedekiah is brought with Jeremiah to wed the High Kings of Ireland, and the full puzzle falls together. The commonwealth ruled over by the Zara line, Haraman, is joined to the Pharaoh's line in David, and the lineage now flows in one stream to the present kings of England. On top of everything else, God got the rock there too, the stone of destiny. Now, these two books are pretty heavy stuff. I don't want you to buy hundreds of them, but I think we ought to have a couple in our bookstore for those that really want to study it. All I'm really pointing out is that history and archaeology keeps making God look lucky. And what's so amazing is they offer the proof and don't know what they're proving. That's what amazes me. Now, I want to tell you something. You got more teaching today than you deserve.